Good morning. In advance of the IUCN, philanthropists from around the world will gather in Honolulu to consider how they'll create environmental impact in China. Carol Fox of the East-West Center gives us a preview. And as two hurricanes are tracking toward Hawaii, we'll get the latest from the Central Pacific Hurricane Center. And what would make 1,500 people brave rainy skies to gather for a pop-up picnic? We'll talk with one of the hosts of Dîner en Blanc. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Dr. Dwayne Priester is taking his 8th grade science students into the field to take part in a worldwide 3D mapping project. And Ruth Sharoma Foster will perform live in our studio in advance of her weekend Atherton concert.
It's Monday, August 29th. That's The Conversation coming up after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation on a Monday. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. There's quite a convergence of ideas taking place in Hawaii this coming week, isn't there?
This week is going to be a very, very big week with the IUCN and with the president's arrival on Wednesday, possibly a hurricane. You know, a lot of things going on, including what we're going to talk about for our very first story. Now, you may have heard the expression that giving begins at home. When your home is China and the efforts are grounded in global environmental issues, well, it could look a little different. International philanthropists, conservationists, business and government leaders will gather in Honolulu this week in advance of the IUCN World Conservation Congress for the East-West Sustainability Summit. On the agenda is how philanthropic partnerships can be struck to take on biodiversity, climate change, the protection and management of natural resources, and a whole lot more. The summit is being convened by the East-West Center and the China Global Philanthropy Institute. Carol Fox is the Director for Special Projects at the East-West Center, and she joins us in our studio this morning. Hi there. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Beautifully stated. Good introduction. Thanks a lot.
Well, it's going to be a very interesting, you know, convergence of ideas and people. And as we look at what does philanthropy look like now in China, because a lot of people, you know, think that that may be somewhat of an oxymoron, you know, Chinese philanthropy. What does it look like?
Well, it's quite amazing how fast China is changing in every way, but especially right now in philanthropy. And about 6 years ago, the East-West Center started a project to look at Chinese philanthropy and was there anything we could do to help them learn more about it. And they were very eager to partner with us. So we've had a long and very successful partnership with China Global Philanthropy Institute and the leader of that, Wang Jianyao. It might surprise some of your listeners to know that Wang Jianyao had a very high-powered job in the government in China, in the Ministry of Civil Affairs. And he had started things like village-based elections in that position. And then along came the horrible earthquake in 2008 in Sichuan. And he was responsible for disaster relief. And he saw that China had all this money pouring in from all over the world and from the Chinese themselves, even in huge amounts and little tiny amounts, because people's hearts went out to all the people affected by that earthquake. And there just wasn't the philanthropic infrastructure to deliver that money to the people who needed it. So he quit his job and he started a thing called China Philanthropy Research Institute. After about, we started this partnership at that same time, and it has evolved.
When people hear about disasters, you're right, hearts go out, money flows in. But for the type of philanthropy that you're talking about now, that's much more proactive, that's looking at taking on deep global environmental concerns, that's a different situation altogether. where you have to engage people at a different level and keep them engaged, because it's not simply a matter of responding to a disaster. How is that looking now in China when you have been working with this partnership for the last 6 years, which doesn't sound like a huge, you know, period of time?
You're right, and that's a really good question. 6 years in China is a very long time. So much happens so quickly. I worked closely with Hank Paulson when I worked for the Nature Conservancy in China, and I remember we were driving to a meeting one day, and he said, "You know, Carol, I've worked all over the world, but never have I worked anywhere where once they make up their minds to do something, they do it better or faster than China." And they have made up their minds to do some amazing things, clean up corruption, clean up the environment, and they understand that they really do need philanthropy, that third sector. There's the government sector, the business sector, and then there's the nonprofit sector. And they've been doing a fabulous job over that 6 years building that sector.
So now, as you have so many high-powered philanthropists, business leaders, government folks who are coming to be in Honolulu at the East-West Center for the next couple of days until the ICUN, and meant to dovetail with that, what, if you had your list of druthers, would be the producibles that you'd like to see come out of this that would mean that we would see some of those actions better and faster?
That's a great question, too. Well, let me just say that over this 6 years, we have convened 5 workshops, which is like the worker bees, people from philanthropic organizations, foundations, et cetera, from the U.S. and from China. And then we decided we had to not only do bottom-up, but we had to do top-down. So we started 3 years ago an East-West Philanthropist Summit where we invited the donors themselves. And we've worked with the Rockefellers and many of the very top philanthropists in China. These are people who've made their fortunes, and now they really want to give back. So what's really exciting about this particular time is we've gone from China-US to international, but we have a very strong representative group of philanthropists from China. For example, Niu Guansheng is one of the leading philanthropists in China. He put all his stock, quit his job as head of his company, put all his stock into the Lao Niu Foundation, and just celebrated the 10th anniversary of that foundation. So,
and what exactly does it do?
They give money to education. They came here. He came here and got inspired by our Children's Discovery Center, and now he has built discovery centers for young children in China, and he plans to build more. He has done a lot for the environment. He gave large gifts with his friend Jack Ma to the Nature Conservancy. And in partnership with Niu Guansheng, he is a sponsor for this East-West Sustainability Summit that we'll be convening beginning tonight, and then tying into the IUCN World Conservation Congress on Thursday. His partner in this effort, and a huge philanthropist in China herself, although a more recent one than Niu Guansheng, is He Qianyu, a woman who started making money by selling and renting small bonsai trees to people to decorate their offices or homes or whatever, and now has the largest landscape design company in China. And she is totally committed to the environment and to making the world a better place.
The point is that a lot of these names we don't recognize because they're not something that, or not names that we hear populating our news. But the point that you're making is that there is philanthropy happening in China in ways that perhaps we haven't understood in past, and that maybe we will understand a lot better after this summit. Thank you so much for coming in.
Right. Thank you. And we're delighted to be partnering with IUCN on a very exciting lunch on Thursday where we're going to celebrate conservation heroes.
All right, well, you just told us about some of them, and we'll see what else comes out of this summit. Carol Fox is Director for Special Projects at the East-West Center. The East-West Sustainability Summit begins today and will run through Thursday.
And this is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14 and coming up, mapping the volcano in 3D. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, recent concerns over hepatitis A and the Zika virus got us wondering about the worst public health emergency in Hawaii history and the measures taken to keep it under control. The Kingdom of Hawaii's Board of Health was created in 1850 by Kamehameha III. In December of 1899, the department investigated the death of a 22-year-old Chinese bookkeeper from an illness it had not seen before. When four other neighbors died, the Board of Health isolated 14 blocks where 10,000 people lived. They were enclosed in what was called a cordon sanitaire, where no one was allowed in or out. When further signs of the outbreak were apparent, the department attempted a controlled burn of infected structures. It raged out of control, destroying roughly 32 acres in and around Chinatown in Honolulu. Today, we're looking for the name of the infectious disease the Kingdom's Board of Health was trying to contain. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know your history. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
It's a job that's usually done by graduate students, three-dimensional mapping of the terrain around Kilauea Volcano. Dr. Dwayne Priester of Mid-Pacific, a believer in applied science, is taking eighth graders to Hawaii Island next month in partnership with a worldwide project called Catalog Earth. Dr. Priester is with us in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
This is taking advantage of a relatively new technology, right? But it's an old idea, which is wanting to get a panoramic view of the Earth, yeah?
Yes. So this is really unique, and we were able to partner with an organization called Catalog.Earth. This is a joint collaboration between Mid-Pacific Catalog Earth, and what we want to do is actually go and work with them to capture the vanishing Earth. And it's an opportunity for us to do it in 360 view. This is unique because often we think of views of the Earth, we see it through either stagnant two-dimensional video or through photography.
Yeah.
But this is an opportunity for those who are actually viewing it to see it in full 360 view. So imagine being immersed in that environment.
As if you were standing there and able to look up, down, all around.
Exactly.
Behind you.
Exactly. What you can do, you can actually connect with all of your senses as you're looking at your environment.
It makes you wish that this had been, you know, that this technology and this kind of thing had been done in past centuries. What an amazing thing it would be.
Oh, yes. And the thing that is amazing is as the Earth is constantly changing, either through natural changes or through global warming, our students are actually going to capture those images. And 20 or 30 years from now, if someone's interested in seeing what volcano looked like or if they're interested in seeing what the glaciers look like, they can actually log on to this video and see it as it was then and imagine that Earth had changed dramatically.
Which it is very likely to do.
Correct.
Well, that's an amazing opportunity. What at the heart of it is a remarkable gizmo.
Yes. So about a year ago, we partnered with GoPro, and GoPro we worked with them to get most of us see the GoPro cameras, and oftentimes you'll see it mounted to a surfboard. We'll see it mounted to the helmet
sure.
of a motorcycle rider. But this particular device, it allows us to mount six GoPro cameras to a rig. It allows us to take it into any environment, and we get a full 360-degree video. And what we do is once we capture that video, we go back to the lab, we stitch it together, and we create a full video for anyone to view.
A really immersive kind of experience, right?
Very much so.
Well, how do you train eighth graders to do this?
It's amazing because we have an amazing teacher, Ms. Leilani Sills. She's very adventurous, but the thing that she did more than anything was she put the camera in the student's hand and she said, imagine what's possible. And the thing that has really amazed us with our students, giving them the opportunity, simply saying, we want you to think about what's possible. We want you to imagine. She just let them run with it. Mm-hmm. And because of that, within a year's time, they've captured some amazing footage of Hawaii.
If you take boundaries down for your expectations of what students can do, and I think we do tend to place boundaries on what the limits are of what one can learn at a certain age, mm-hmm. one is often surprised, don't you think?
Very much so. You mentioned this earlier in that the kind of work that our middle school students are doing is actually graduate level work, and you actually hear some professionals doing this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
And last Wednesday, we actually had a video conference with Catalog.Earth, and they mentioned something that our students heard for the first time. In preparing for the trip to Volcano National Park, they said to us, you students are amazing because we've now partnered with Berkeley, and we partnered with several professors from Berkeley to do work in the national parks in Northern California. Those professors are bringing graduate students with them who are just now beginning to tap into this kind of technology. Our students, they said to our students, you're doing the same kind of work that they are now starting to get into. And it happened because we said to our students, we believe you can do this, now go experiment. And the thing that's really unique about Mid-Pacific is we encourage our students to take risks. And we said to them, here's equipment, it's new, try it out. And that's exactly what they've done. And like I said, they've captured some amazing footage.
In some ways, they never grew up in a world that didn't have amazing technology of this kind.
That's right.
That's probably an advantage in a way, don't you think?
It's definitely an advantage because when we talk about electronic devices, all of our students in the middle school, they're part of that digital culture, and they see themselves as connected to those devices. They don't know a world without it, so whenever we say to them, experiment, it's what they do on a daily basis. So they don't have the boundaries that we as adults have when it comes to working with this kind of equipment. The other thing that we're doing as educators is we're teaching them to ask lots of questions when they go into an environment. Just imagine, look at shadowing, look at the lighting, think about what's possible, and think about ways in which you want to communicate a narrative to those around you. And when we say those things to them, then they begin to question, they begin to answer. And the result of that is we get footage that is able to tell a story that their peers will understand.
What are the things that concern them the most?
I think they want to tell stories that are relevant. They want to make sure that the images that they're capturing are able to communicate what it is they're thinking, and they want to make sure that they tell a story for generations to come. We have encouraged our students to think about themselves in the construct of a larger global community. And the other thing that's important to mention with the images they're capturing is they're going to publish this content to Creative Commons. And they know by publishing this content to Creative Commons, they are communicating a message about an earth that's constantly shifting. So that's of great concern to them.
It's got to be, being able to do this kind of work has got to be a great source of pride to them, too. It's a pleasure to talk to you this morning.
Thanks
for coming in.
Thank you.
Dr. Dwayne Priester is the principal of Mid-Pacific's Middle School, and his students are going to the Big Island on September 13th to capture 3D images of the volcano landscape for Catalog.Earth, a worldwide project to document the world's land and seascapes in three dimensions.
Next time you're driving, check out the license plate frames of vehicles around you and see if you can spot one of Hawaii Public Radio's more than 4,000 sustaining members. We'd like to send a big mahalo to these supporters whose contributions provide the station with a source of reliable income. Ray Carbolido of Honolulu, Stephen Polotsky of Kapolei, and Catherine Melanson of Haleiwa. If you'd like to help us steer a stable course into the future, you can become a sustainer, too. Just take a look at hawaiipublicradio.org, where you can find our donate button, or you can call us to find out more at 955-8821. For years, HART officials refused to release how much money subcontractors were being paid on the biggest infrastructure project in the state's history. But now the secret is out, and Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Ah, bit my tongue there. Sorry about that. Anywho,
you were probably choking back at the huge amount of money that's going to subcontractors.
Oh,
our money, by the way.
This is
taxpayer
a lot of
money.
This is $235 million in 1 year. Why is it that it took this long for us to be able to find out?
HART said for the longest time that it didn't have the legal authority to access these records. You know, mind you, it's contractors that hire the subcontractors to work on the rail project. HART said any disclosure had to be on a voluntary basis by the contractors who hired those subcontractors. Well, we looked into that, Nick Gruby in particular, our reporter, and found out, well, that's just not true. In fact, there are numerous documents that had access to that subcontractor data. You could release it if you want to. Well, finally, at the urging of the city council, HART finally released that information. Now, this is just one fiscal year, the one that ended June 30th, but it is a lot of money. Out of $432 million, nearly half a billion, in invoices, about $235 million went to subcontractors.
So did anybody ask HART why, if obviously this were possible, they didn't do it, and what they thought of the fact that now we know?
Well, that's exactly the case here, and now HART presumably will provide this information going forward. And as a service to our readers and for those listening out there that want to go to Nick Ruby's article, it's on our homepage today, we actually put up a database. You can search and find all those contractors and subcontractors, the precise dollar amount, mm-hmm. exactly the work they did. We feel that this is really a service. We've been, as you know, reporting on the rail as part of our off-track series for some time, but you could also call this another one of our series, It's Your Money, because this is exactly where our money is going, and it's really it really kind of opens your eyes to just how expensive this public works project is.
All right, so all of this has been, you've had to pull this out, but right. Will HART be populating any of this going forward?
Oh, in terms of putting it on their own website?
Yeah, I mean, or being able to just, share the information in a way that will be easily digestible and that you can be able to, pull into to your database.
You know, that's a good question. As you know, HART's had its troubles recently, and I do know that they do post the contractor information. I don't know whether they've posted the subcontractor. That's something that I should find out and report back on you. I can tell you, though, it is on our website, and I encourage folks to go to civilbeat.org and check it out.
All right, Chad. Thanks a whole bunch. We will talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat, and every day he joins us with a reality check.
So
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
In local news, the focus is now on hurricanes moving toward Hawaii. As of now, Hurricane Madeline is about 695 miles east of Hilo, pretty much where it's been for most of the morning. Hurricane Lester is about 1,000 miles behind it. With the IUCN World Conservation Congress starting this week, President Obama scheduled to arrive on Wednesday, and quite possibly along with it, Hurricane Madeline. It could be perhaps the perfect storm. Chevy Chevalier is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service at the Central Pacific Hurricane Center, and he's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
I mean, very clearly, everyone is quite concerned about the convergence of all of these things happening this week. Is there anything more that, you know, we've talked about this and been getting reports, but anything more that you know that we should?
Well, I mean, overnight, we went from, you know, since yesterday afternoon, a tropical storm to a Cat 2 hurricane. So rapid intensification of now Hurricane Madeline. And we expect it to intensify over the next 12 to 24 hours, maybe another 5 to 10 miles per hour with the wind. So we're expecting it to peak out at about 105 miles per hour, 110 miles per hour, low on Category 2, but still a Category 2, and then a gradual, very gradual weakening day 3 into day 4. And we expect it right now, the best forecast track takes it to the south of the Big Island. That doesn't mean they're not going to get impacts. We're talking about high surf, some pretty good winds, and rain and potential flooding, depending on how close to the coast Madeline goes.
So nothing at all to be complacent about just because it may be moving south of the island.
Well, that's the message we want to continue to convey, is that everybody should be prepared, especially with this double whammy this week, especially if you're on the Big Island in Maui. Lester, as you mentioned, is right behind it, relatively speaking. We expect the impacts from Lester, which is actually a low-end Category 3, a major hurricane right now, and we expect the impacts from that Wednesday, Thursday, into Friday. And that one, with the current forecast track, is expected to take a northwestward turn as it approaches the islands and could affect every one of the islands in the chain.
Which is to say it's going to be a very messy week, and people should take this quite seriously. Regardless of what happens, it's going to be rainy, it's going to be nasty. But if there is a real change and we feel impacts from either one of those, this is not the time to be complacent.
Absolutely. Be vigilant. It only takes one. You know, the worst storm is the one that hits you. So, you know, we've only had 5 tropical storm and or hurricanes in 70 years make landfall, including earlier this year, Tropical Storm Darby and Tropical Storm Mazelle a couple of years ago. But those were eye-openers that it can indeed happen. We definitely don't want to be impacted by a hurricane or tropical storm. And if we are, though, you want to make sure you're prepared. You have every emergency plan in place. You have all your supplies ready to go. Do not wait till the last minute.
That's always what we like to say, and yet very often people do. Even when we have, as you say, in recent memory, some distinct examples of what can happen. Is there anything that really, you know, makes a difference as you keep putting out these same calls? And certainly we've heard that from civil defense over many, many years, even with these experiences, that we seem to forget how much damage this can do and how quickly.
Well, if you've lived on Kauai for a long time, 25 years or so, you definitely remember Iniki and how much damage a particular storm can do. That was a hurricane, and in the billions of dollars, and of course, unfortunately, the lives lost. So we are continuously, from June 1st until November, the end of November, the hurricane season, under the gun. And everybody needs to remember that. We do peak from August into September. That's when we see the most frequency of storms. And we're definitely seeing it this year. Last year was record-setting. But we don't want to let our guard down just because the waters are cooling. We definitely have the recipe out there with still warm waters. We have less wind shear right now, so that's a recipe for pretty intense storms, tropical storms, and even hurricanes. So, you know, we had a quiet start to the season, the month of June in the eastern Pacific. Didn't have any storms. The first storm didn't come around until July 2nd, but then we had 10 from July 2nd to August 7th, and now we're already on Madeline, which is M. That's a 13th named storm originating in the East Pac. So it's still an active season, and remember, we still have an outlook or a forecast for an above-normal season this year.
And it's a long way till November. Thanks very, very much for joining us. We'll be checking back with you.
Sure, no problem.
Chevy Chevalier is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service at the Central Pacific Hurricane Center in Honolulu.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in our dark island skies, as well as what's happening in the simply massive universe around our tiny planet. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Aloha, Christopher. Welcome back. What do you have?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars and Saturn as they appear close together in the southern sky after sunset. They will be near the constellation of Scorpius, otherwise known as Maui's fishhook. The bright star Antares in Scorpius will form a triangle with the two planets, making for a great celestial show. The moon this week will be waning, and we shall see a return to dark skies.
And we have dark matter on the radar, I understand, this week, and a new discovery that is connected to the Mauna Kea summit.
We do indeed. Astronomers at two Mauna Kea observatories have announced that they have observed a mysterious new type of galaxy around 300 million light years from the Earth. What's strange about this new galaxy is that it appears to be composed of almost 99% dark matter. This galaxy is known as Dragonfly 44, and despite being as big as our own Milky Way, it only emits about 1% of the light.
So which observatories were involved, and also if you can help explain, how do you see something if it's a bunch of dark matter?
Well, the Keck Observatory was the first to observe it using the Deep Imaging Multi-Object Spectrograph. Follow-up observations were conducted at Gemini using the Gemini Multi-Object Spectrometer. Now, these two instruments are perfectly suited for spotting very dim, practically invisible objects in the universe.
Can you try to explain in layman's terms as much as possible what that is and what makes this galaxy so full of it?
Well, basically, dark matter is stuff we can't see because it's dark. It is thought to come in various shapes and sizes. Some dark matter could be dark clouds of gas and dust, and maybe dim planets and stars, as well as other objects that don't emit or reflect very much light. Another form of dark matter is thought to be more exotic and comes in the form of mysterious particles that we think exist, but we haven't directly detected them yet.
And so if there are more dark galaxies out there, any chance some of those could be a bit closer than this one? We just can't see it, that it's there.
Absolutely. In fact, there may be dark galaxies very close to the Milky Way.
Sounds fascinating. Christopher Phillips and another stargazer here on HPR. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week.
Some say it's a lot of trouble for too little fun. To others, the planning, the rules, the toting of all the required stuff is just all part of the experience of the annual pop-up picnic with a surprise location, Dîner en Blanc. The worldwide phenomenon has a 28-year history and has grown to include 70 cities. But it's not open to everyone. You have to be invited to buy tickets. Now, over the weekend, 1,500 people converged on the rooftop of the Hawaii Convention Center, and the party raged even as it started to rain. We're curious about what drives the planning, the psychology, and so much else behind Dîner en Blanc. Malie Moran is one of the event hosts, and she joins us now in our studio. Well, first of all, maybe I should say congratulations for having survived. That's a lot of planning to get it off the ground from your end.
Thank you so much, Bethann. We're very happy to have had our third annual over this past weekend.
But watching how this has grown in Honolulu, as we've watched it grow over, you know, almost three decades around the world and so many cities in different continents, that there seems to be a hunger in people for something that this uniquely offers. What is that something?
So I think it's a hunger of experience, of being a part of something that's so unique, and just the element of surprise and all of those things that when they come together, it just creates something that is truly indescribable, truly beautiful, and really when all of those parts come together as a whole, it's really such a unique phenomena.
28 years ago, this started in Paris, and it was just somewhat of a lark, you know, people dressing in white so they could find each other, brought together. How did that move from a sort of a whimsical idea into what we have seen happen over the last 28 years?
Yeah, so it originated when a gentleman named Mr. Pasquier traveled the world for several years, and he wanted to come together on his return and share his travels with friends and acquaintances. And because so many people wanted to come to this gathering, he said, let's go to a park nearby and dress in white to be recognizable to each other. And I think what touched me, one of the things that touched me so much, is that it's built on friendship and beauty and elegance and around sharing a meal together.
But a very specialized meal. I mean, you're not going to bring anything in there from, you know, Mickey D's or anyplace else. It's got to be very, very specific, elegant, crystal, flatware, china, nothing plastic, everything beautiful, and watching how people have a great deal of creativity in the way they set their tables, but all with that one sensibility of elegance.
It's true. It's true. It's we just are so amazed at the level of investment and participation that people put into this. And so even with the investment of the dinner that they create, you know, people spend a lot of time creating something elegant and amazing.
I mean, they're highly invested, and there's also an element of exclusivity about that, too. And some people have been very critical about that, saying that, you know, you have to have somebody who you know who went to invite you in. I mean, you would say that's probably the basis of friendship. But how else do you counter this when they say this is really something that really isn't open to everybody?
Well, you know, you can look at it two ways. And I mean, I guess in one sense, we're so excited that many people in Honolulu have taken to the concept and want to come. And on the other hand, it's like we wish we could bring everyone, right? But we're just contained by our venue and by our production limits. And so we can grow the event little by little every year. But, you know, it's just at the end of the day, we can't take everyone. And we're just so happy that people love it and
clearly,
embrace
though,
it.
This year, you went up by a quarter. I mean, you had 300 more people than you did last year. And the fact that people seem to have this real need for surprise, and they're willing to invest so much time, effort, energy, and money into being able to do it, too. Well, we'll watch and see how this grows over next year. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Maile Moran is one of the hosts of Dîner en Blanc Honolulu.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting the Manhattan Transfer in two shows nightly, on stage tomorrow through September 4th. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, when diet and exercise don't do the trick, that causes stress, and then you're even worse off, right?
Exactly. Today we're going to talk about what is that mind-body-food connection? Why do some of us crave foods when we're stressed? And what can we do to really help ourselves be healthier? Because there's a lot of folks out there that, you know, they watch their diet, they exercise a lot, and they don't feel like they're seeing any improvement. And it really isn't because they're failing in any category. It may just be that their stress hormones are so high, there's nothing they can do about it except for relax.
So stress can directly impede your ability to burn fat?
Absolutely. If your cortisol levels and stress hormones are high, your body is in this constant mode of conserve all of what you eat. And that's what happens. We'll talk more today.
It seems awfully unfair, but I guess that's one thing you'll figure out tonight at 5.
You got it.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to deliver the spark that ignites giving. Philanthropy is thought to be a triumvirate made from the donor, the recipient, and the result. I spoke with filmmaker Edgy Lee about the impact of sponsors on filmmaking and vice versa. Do you think that today's audience has a lot more power than they used to? Do they impact sponsors and donors? Are they in charge?
I don't see why it can't be. It used to be that the sponsors, let the big networks, controlled the media and what we were given. When the audience realizes that they have great control, that you can watch a film that tells you that green is good, sharing, teamwork is good for the community, and because it's good for the community, then it becomes great for your city, your nation, the planet, and you know what? It's good for you in the long run. When that message hits and it's carried by a 9-year-old or a 99-year-old, and people demand that product or they demand that kind of messaging, sponsors will follow.
Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we remembered a turn-of-the-century disease outbreak and the disastrous public health response. The first victims were diagnosed in late 1899, and by 1900, the Chinatown neighborhood where they lived was in forced lockdown, enforced by a military cordon. Residents' homes were searched, their interiors soaked with carbolic acids, and their possessions dumped into the street. An attempt to burn out the infection led to the disastrous 1900 Chinatown fire that destroyed at least 38 acres. The fire and the isolation of the neighborhood failed to contain the plague, and a few cases were later reported as far away as Waialua. Those cases were later determined to have been carried by the railroad that linked Honolulu with sugar plantations in Aiea, Waipahu, and Waialua. And there had been no sign of the disease in Hawaii since 1910, which is a relief because the bubonic plague is a serious threat to public health.
And we heard from Cora Yamamoto, who called us from Liliha with the answer, and we'll be receiving the T-shirt, although I understand we had lots of calls on this one, but the correct answer came from Cora Yamamoto. So thanks very much for calling us quickly. And if you have a Backyard Quiz question for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Ruth Shiroma Foster is an interactive performer, drawing her fellow performers and, most importantly, her audiences into the familiar and classic songs that form her repertoire. You can expect to be asked to participate during her show, so expect to sing and feel free to bring your ukulele when you come to hear her. She's got a show this weekend in our Atherton studio, and she and Norm Foster are with us this morning in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What drives you to the music that you love the best?
What drives me?
What makes you, yeah.
Yeah, I look for songs that speak to my my heart, that offer like a feeling of love and emotion and depth. So that doesn't stay in one genre for me. I love jazz. I love Hawaiian. And the people that are on my program, they're also versatile too. So we have a couple opera singers, and they're gonna do "Time to Say Goodbye," the duet that Andre Bocelli and Sarah Brightman sing. And I love Broadway. There's Broadway, and it's just, I think the unifying quality is a warmth, passion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I choose the songs for my programs.
Sounds as if it's the story that's told that's especially important.
Definitely the story. I have a background in journalism and storytelling, and so I love stories. And along with that, on stage, the combination of people we have Amber Naramore, we have Ryan Souza, who's a singer. Amber and Ryan are singers. Norm Foster, my husband, on clarinet, who's here in the studio. Mm-hmm. And we have Dae Han, which he's a fabulous percussionist. And so along with the music that we bring, we have the stories that we bring to the songs. And I think whoever comes to our shows, they're going to connect with us, not just like the music, but everything about who we are as people and the stories we bring and the warmth that we have together on stage.
Sounds good. And one of the things you're going to do is kind of warm everybody up with a little interactive back and forth.
Yes. So is that something we want to give it a shot?
Let's do it.
One of the easiest chords to play on the ukulele is A minor. So I'm going to ask the audience to just strum on 2 and 4. And echo after me. But we don't have people singing, so you guys are going to echo on your instruments. It's going to go. Hey.
Okay, we're all warmed up.
Yes. And you know what's fun about it is Ryan Souza, he's such a great singer. He leads a gospel choir, and he will throw it down for the audience in terms of what he wants them to sing. He'll throw some fancy stuff and he'll challenge them a little. I think it'll be fun. Yeah.
Excellent. There was also another song you told me you were going to do. One of yours?
It's a song by Jewel that I think conveys a lot of intimacy. It's called Near You Always. Please don't say I love you. Those words, they touch me much too deeply. They make my core tremble. Don't think you realize the effect you have over me. Please don't look at me like that. It just makes me wanna make you near me always. Please don't kiss me so sweet. It makes me crave 1,000 kisses to follow. And please don't touch me like that. Makes every other embrace seem pale and shallow. Please don't come so close. It just makes me wanna make you near me always. Please don't bring me flowers. They only whisper the sweet things you'll say. Don't try to understand me. Your hands already know too much anyway. Just makes me wanna make you near me always. And when you look in my eyes, please know my heart is in your hands. It's nothing that I understand, but in your arms you have complete power over me. So be gentle if you please, 'cause your hands are in my hair, but my heart is in your teeth, and it
makes me wanna make you near me always. Your hands are in my hair, but my heart is in your teeth, and it makes me wanna make you near me always. Wanna be near you always. Wanna be near you always.
Ruth, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Thanks, Norm, for coming in.
My pleasure.
Singer, songwriter, pianist, and ukulele player Ruth Shiroma Foster will share HPR's Atherton Studio stage with her musical colleagues and the audience on September 3rd, that's Saturday, at 7:30 p.m.
Going to be back with you tomorrow morning, and I'm just sort of in an easy place after having listened to Ruth Shiroma Foster about that, but we've got to say goodbye pretty soon.
Well, it's there's a lot going on this week, as you said, and we'll be keeping an eye on the weather, of course.
You bet, including tomorrow, talking with the Hawaii Teachers Standards Board. We're going to really take a look at what does credentialization mean, as we've had some discussions with teachers from other places who have come here and tried to teach. Well, what do they really need to teach? We're going to talk again with the Hawaii Teachers Standard Board and find out.
And young voices from across the Pacific speak to the need for ocean conservation.
We'd like to hear from you, too. And our phone line is always available anytime you'd like it. It's 808-792-8217, so you can leave us your comments. Or if you like to just email it, you can do that, too. Our address is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Or on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
Past shows are archived under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandergut.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.